Welcome to The Market, sponsored by the CME Group, Dateline Chicago, Friday, December 2nd. Orion Samuelson, along with Max Armstrong, here with you for our weekly get-together. And as we look at the tumultuous marketplace, where do we start this week? Do we start with the stock market, or do we start with oil? Well, oil did have an impact on the stock market this week, so maybe we'll start with that, because finally, the OPEC countries said, yes, we will cut supply to bring crude oil prices higher. And even some non-OPEC countries said, we will cut our production levels as well to bring oil production back in line with demand. So oil prices rallied for their best week in at least 5 years today, steadying above $51 a barrel following OPEC's decision to cut crude output. And after that deal was announced Wednesday, the market focused on the implementation and the impact of OPEC's first cuts in production since 2008, to be joined by Russia and possibly other non-OPEC producers. Crude prices were pressured by data showing oil output in Russia rose in November to the highest level since the Soviet Union disappeared. And they plan to use that record November oil production as the baseline when it cuts output. But with cuts being implemented next year, only against end of 2016 levels, analysts said there was still a possibility that oversupply, which has cut in half oil prices since 2014, remains a factor next year. And then there's the other question. What about shale oil, the Bakken oil field in North Dakota and Canada and surrounding states? Well, over the past several years, they have been able to cut the cost of producing oil from shale by 50%, which means the Bakken oil field could become much more active again, and it'll be interesting to see over the next few weeks how many drilling rigs we add to the Bakken oil field. But there's no question that the United States probably could do something about keeping oil production levels at the level they are. Certainly worth watching. I'm a little surprised we haven't seen a bigger jump in gasoline prices yet, but I'm sure we will see that, because any rumor or any fact that would cut the output certainly does bring a higher price for gasoline. Okay, that's the oil this week. Let's go to the stock market, because today the stock market ended little changed after a payroll report did little to recast expectations for an interest rate hike from the Federal Reserve this month, and bank stocks cooled to round out their fourth straight week of gains. A U.S. Labor Department report showed employers in private and public sectors hired more people last month than economists had expected, further strengthening expectations of a rate hike by the Fed when the central bank meets December 13th and 14th. Now, reaction to the jobs report today, hardly any at all. The number that came in was 178,000 new jobs added in the month of November, and that was about 3,000 less than expected. So there wasn't all that much reaction today to the monthly report on employment. Now, let's take a look at the changes for the week, because for the week, the Dow Industrial Average ended, I guess you could call it unchanged, ending the week down about a tenth of a percent. The Dow gained a tenth of a percent. Let me get that right. The S&P 500 fell for the week. It was down 1%, and the NASDAQ composite lost 2 2/3% for the week. So what do we look for next week? Still another full trading week before we get into the Christmas, New Year's holiday shutdowns. But next week, the Commerce Department will issue factory orders data. That'll happen on Tuesday. Analysts are saying new orders for factory goods expected to have risen 2.5% in October after adding 0.3% in September. And then on Friday, data from the Commerce Department expected to show that sales at wholesalers likely increased by 0.4% in October. Earnings reports still continuing. Costco Wholesale Corporation releases first quarter results on Wednesday. The warehouse club retailer pre-announced a 3% increase in quarterly sales. But deflation in grocery stores is likely to have reduced the sales, while traffic was slightly low in the first 2 weeks of November ahead of the presidential election. But several of the earnings reports coming from food companies and supermarkets have been interesting to watch, because remember a few years ago when food prices were going up, we heard about that just about every day in the media. But now we've been watching food prices decline over the past several months, and it hardly gets any notice. Tuesday, the luxury home builder Toll Brothers expected to report an increase in revenue and profit for the fourth quarter, again boosted by an increase in home sales, an improving job market, and a healthy economy continue to lift demand for housing, and investors will be looking for comments on order trends and pricing and an update to the full-year forecast from Toll Brothers. Sears Holding Corporation will issue third quarter earnings on Thursday. There, investors will be eager to know how the struggling retailer is gearing up for the holiday quarter and for any updates on its financial position, business restructuring, or sales plans. So, not quite as much activity in the earnings report next week. And a fairly quiet week for government reports as well. One of the reports that came out this week that I always like to follow, particularly on models, the top 20 selling vehicles in the United States in November. Because I remember the day when if you had a pickup truck, you were more than likely a construction worker or a farmer or a rancher. But my, how that has changed. Once again, in November, number one selling vehicle in the United States, the Ford F-Series pickup truck. Sales went up 10.5% and totaled 72,089. Second best selling vehicle, Chevy Silverado, a pickup. It was up 0.6%. Third best selling vehicle, the Ram pickup. It was up 8%. But then you have to go all the way to number four to find an actual automobile, not a pickup. Number four, Toyota Corolla, with sales gains of about 12% in November. The Toyota Camry following down 10% or 9%. And then the Toyota RAV4, which increased in sales 2.7%. Get all the way down to 7 before you find a Honda, and that was the Accord, and then number 9 was the Honda CR-V, and you get all the way down to 11 before you find a Ford U.S. vehicle, Ford Escape, and sales of the Ford Escape went up 10.5% in November. But with the success of the pickup truck in the United States, both Ford Motor and General Motors announced this week that they're going to increase production of pickup trucks in China, because apparently the same thing is happening there with demand. No longer a farmer vehicle, but it is now, particularly for the wealthy in China, a popular vehicle. So both Ford and General Motors, taking a look at that, think that, hey, there's a market there for what we do. Back to the report today from the Labor Department, the jobless rate fell to a 9-year low. Unemployment now at 4.6%, and we haven't seen that for 9 years. So anyway, those are some of the reports that the market had to deal with this week, and we're going to take a look now at what the grain and livestock the agricultural commodity markets had to deal with this week. Because again, Max Armstrong standing by with another analyst who watches this market activity every day. And we'll be checking in with Max and his guest, Terry Rogensack, when we continue on The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Visiting with us this weekend, Terry Rogensack from Hightower. It's been a while. Good to see you again.
Great to be here.
Well, there's no shortage of things to talk about, but as we look across that landscape, is there anything exciting? I mean, you have to look back at the November rally we've just seen in soybeans, and that was kind of a nice surprise, wasn't it?
Yes, definitely. And it's been a demand market, a very impressive demand market across the board. China has been aggressively buying soybeans over the last couple of months, and it's really come from their impressive crush margins and their inversions that they've got. Cash meal is above the futures market, and the futures are all inverted, so that's really pressing the Chinese crusher to be an aggressive buyer.
Your longtime colleague, David Hightower, has gone over to China, I know, and has spoken there, participated in meetings on various occasions. You've long been bullish on China, but others were wringing their hands over the not-so-robust growth, not as much as we've seen in the past in the Chinese economy. Are you still pretty bullish on what you see over there?
We are, and we're also seeing Southeast Asia in general really picking up over the last couple of years. The Thailand and Indonesia, Malaysia, those areas, and Vietnam, we're seeing a very aggressive increases in their meat production and increases in their feed grain imports across the board from aquaculture all the way to their expansion in poultry and in pork.
Sobering, though, are the numbers of production from the United States and what we anticipate from South America. Give us a little bit of a summary as to what you see there at this moment.
Well, the biggest problem short term, I think, is that the Chinese demand for soybeans is going to shift over to South America seasonally, which is normal. And we're eventually going to saturate that demand. We're looking at 500 million carryout here. And when you look at the bean versus corn ratio for next year, a lot of we've done central Indiana acres, dollars per acre, and we're sitting at beans favoring corn at the best level in since 2006. So the 5 million plus acres in beans looks like it could happen for next year, and corn might pull back some. One other thing on corn, though, demand, even this morning it came out that for 2017, over 900 feed companies in China have tried to get the import quotas for corn for next year. And with all the talk of the massive stockpiles of corn over in China, why would more than 900 feed companies and starch companies really want those import quotas? They're applying to get import quotas for 2017, so they want to import corn next year, so that might tell us something about the quality of those giant corn stocks.
There's been that chatter for many, many weeks that a lot of that stuff that's been sitting around for many seasons, a lot of that corn is out of condition. And this most recent report seems to perhaps add some credence to that.
That could be the case. And, you know, they've kept out a lot of DDGs and a lot of sorghum and a lot of they're trying their best. But we're still sitting with the price of corn in China higher than the world market, and they're going to be attracted to imports. We do have a supply issue in corn coming with 24 million tons, if the USDA estimates are correct, 24 million ton increase in production, Brazil and Argentina combined, this year against last year.
And then the anticipation that we would have a big crop in 2017 in the United States, potentially. There needs to be a hiccup somewhere. You can't count on that every year, though, can you?
No, you cannot. You know, and the so a supply issue is certainly something that could happen very quickly, and you could lose 20, 30, 40 million tons if it happens in the U.S. or if it happens in China, if you get a 15% yield hit. You know, the other thing I'd say about demand, saw an article yesterday about feed grain demand. If China were to work their way up to a per capita meat consumption the same as Taiwan, it would take 128 million tons of extra feed grain just to reach that level.
Are they capable of producing within their own country that amount of meat, or would we also see correspondingly meat imports rising with China too?
That could be a lot of imports of meat, and
they've got to be fed somewhere, though, don't they?
Yeah, they're not going to get 128 million tons out of China, no.
The Chinese buyers are shrewd buyers. I mean, they have a long and well-deserved reputation for that. What are they up to here in this fall of 2017, just after a presidential election, just before a change of administration in the United States, amid all of the saber-rattling that we've heard about trade and shipping jobs offshore, all of the talk that took place during the campaign? What are they up to here?
Well, there is a lot of theory out there that they've been more aggressive than normal and wanting to book those beans early in case there's some kind of trade war type issues developing with the Trump administration. We happen to think the bark is louder than the bite and that a lot of things are going to get smoothed out from all the rhetoric. But for right now, that's one of the theories, that they booked ahead and then they're going to end up with a period where their stocks are too high and they're going to need to wait until they start importing again.
A hole in demand would develop then. There would be this void. We've seen that before, haven't we, Terry?
Yes, and if we see that as South America produces an extra 5 million tons than last year into their harvest, then we could be in trouble. We're also hearing that South America, some of their early harvested areas are going to be starting to harvest as early as late December. So they're going to have beans available right into early January for shipment on the world market.
So the need to come to the United States for soybeans then would be pretty small, because they'll have that bank to open up there in South America.
Yeah, and while meal is in high demand in China, they're just importing the beans and making their own meal to fill that void. U.S. meal basis is about as bad as it's been at the Gulf since 2012. A lot of talk in the U.S. that a lot of meal is sitting around at plants and they're trying to get it out there. So we're starting to see some cracks in the bullish setup for beans in the U.S. And we would not be surprised to see a pretty good break in beans unless there's a weather development in South America.
Well, let me ask you about soybean oil. Hasn't the bean oil market been providing a little bit of direction this fall? And does that relate back to something you were talking about earlier, some of those other Asian nations? I think of Indonesia, Malaysia, where they are big producers of palm oil.
Extremely tight palm oil stocks. And the fact that we're just now getting to the point where monthly production in Indonesia will be similar to a year ago and won't start really going much above a year ago until the first quarter of 2017. So with those extremely tight stocks that were drawn down over the past year, you can have all kinds of issues. I mean, it's going to might take some time to put in a top for the vegetable oil markets, but it looks like that's coming over the next month or so.
Isn't it a little more unusual for us to see oil driving the bean complex? That doesn't happen that much, does it, Terry?
No, it does not, and that's why we have a lot of concern with the meal activity in the U.S. and the slowdown in some of the exports we've seen there and the too much supply around.
The dollar certainly strengthened after the election, and that has become a factor. I know in many parts of the world. Is that still the case? Is it still hurting our competitiveness in terms of exports of grains overall?
Yes, it can.
You don't seem to be convinced that it's been that big a factor.
Well, right now, corn is the cheapest corn in the world still. And U.S. corn is cheaper than all the other corn availabilities. But Brazil corn is coming down very rapidly over the past month. So we'll have to see when Brazil and Argentina corn get cheaper and when that might happen. And again, the corn production cycle really gets going later in South America than the beans. So you're talking about the second quarter is when we have to watch. And the USDA numbers really show a sharp drop off in corn exports for next year from this year.
Is wheat impacted substantially by the exchange rates? In other words, has that perhaps been a bigger factor, the wheat market more impacted by the strength of the dollar?
That's probably the biggest factor when you're looking at Argentina wheat and Australia wheat coming on right now from their harvest, and the record Russian crop from last year, and the European wheat that's out there. The U.S. is the supplier of last resort, especially when the dollar is doing what it's doing.
We really have moved down the list, haven't we, from 30 years ago, a pretty substantial supplier of wheat to the world. Now we're an afterthought.
Yeah, and from a currency point of view, too. We're in a rough spot for wheat. We've got a lot of supply around. The market's really, really oversold, but, we got to wait till something happens production-wise around the world, and there's wheat coming all the time. The India situation is not as... The weather there is not as good as the trade has thought it would be by now, and that's a situation that we need to be watching.
Thank you for the visit. We appreciate it, Terry. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Terry Rogensack at our studio this weekend from Hightower.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
In a few days, I will be making my annual trip to Washington, D.C. I do it every year. I have for the last 38 years, and the purpose of the trip to interview the Secretary of Agriculture. And the Secretary takes a look back, takes a look ahead. This year will be a little different because Tom Vilsack, looking ahead, will not be looking at continuing as Secretary of Agriculture. And actually, our man who covers activity on the farm front in Washington, Patrick Haggerty, a few days ago sat down to talk to Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack.
After interviewing Secretary Vilsack for his 8 years in office, I opened my last interview with him with the question, review your 8 years in office. He said, that's a long list.
You know, we now have more opportunities for our farm families in terms of what they grow and where they grow it and where they sell it, what size of operations that they can be, how we can get young and beginning farmers into the business, far more extended opportunities there. The disaster programs and the safety net, I think, is more defensible than it was with the old direct payment system to the average citizen in this country. Our nutrition programs, obviously, are providing help and assistance to young people. And I can tell you that we're going to have a generation of healthier children because of the school lunch changes and the school snack changes and the WIC, Women, Infant, Children, package changes. Rural development, we've made an historic investment, nearly 6,000 water treatment and sewage treatment projects, 185,000 to 200,000 miles of electric lines that have been improved, hundreds of broadband projects, over 100,000 businesses help create and support nearly 500,000 jobs, unemployment down, poverty rates down, food insecurity among kids at its lowest rate, food safety. We are saving lives, more lives today than we did 8 years ago with some changes that are historic and unique. So across the board, Natural Conservation Service, basically we now have a record number of acres enrolled in conservation projects. We're leveraging more resources from the outside in conservation. Our forest service now has a forest planning rule, first one in 30 years. We worked collaboratively with other agencies in a very innovative and creative way. So regardless of how you look at it, I think rural America is better off.
President-elect Trump has not named a new agriculture secretary, but this agriculture secretary wants to make sure that his successor will be ready from day one to run a large and important department.
And I myself am working on a private communication to the new secretary. Usually it's a one-page, welcome to the USDA, you're lucky to have the job. Mine's going to be 24 pages in length because there's a lot to tell this new individual about a department, because I think that even if you're the most tuned-in, knowledgeable person, you don't have a full understanding of the extent of what USDA does until you actually have the job.
Secretary Vilsack closed the interview by thanking the people he worked so hard to serve these past 8 years.
And I also want to thank the farmers, the ranchers, the people who live in rural America for their dedication to our country, for the working relationship we've had. I think it's been a good one, and I'm proud of the work that we've done, and I'm proud of the work that they do every day.
In Washington, D.C., Patrick Haggerty.
I think farmers and ranchers were well aware of it, but they made it official at the USDA this past week when they came out with the projected net farm income for the year 2016. Lower commodity prices, particularly livestock, dairy, and poultry farms, the net farm income down 17% from a year ago. That will put it at $66.9 billion. That's the updated forecast from the agency's Economic Research Service. On the other hand, we did get a statement from Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack stating that U.S. farmers and ranchers continue to rise to the challenge of supplying the world with high-quality American-grown products at a projected $134 billion in the upcoming year, 2017. U.S. farm exports continue to rally and remain on the record-setting pace of the past 8 years. This is a very significant number because since 2009, the United States has exported more than $1 trillion in agricultural products, far more than any other period in our history. So the $134 billion forecast represents an increase of $4.33 billion from this year of 2016 and would be the sixth highest total on record. I hope that the cabinet members and President-elect Trump will take note of the importance of agricultural trade not only to farmers and ranchers but to the U.S. economy, and make sure that the U.S. continues to be well represented in trade agreements around the world. Now, the market activity. Let's go to the Mercantile Exchange. Live cattle futures today fell more than 2%. That is their steepest daily decline in 1.5 months. December live cattle down $2.35 for the month. February cattle down $2.50. Futures retreated after hitting a three-month high on Thursday in response to the bulk of slaughter-ready or fed cattle that sold at $114 to $115 per hundredweight. And as far as the hog market, again, weakness there. The December hog contract did close higher, up 52 cents at $50.75. But most actively traded February lean hog futures down a nickel to $54.02. Turning to the grain market, wheat ended the week down 3.6%. You know the reason. Heavy supplies around the world. As a matter of fact, Egypt continues to buy its wheat from Russia and countries closer to it. We don't even offer wheat because we know we are simply priced out of the market. So, taking a look at where we'll start trading on Monday, December wheat, 387.5 a bushel. December corn, 377 and three-quarter cents a bushel. And January soybeans will start the week at $10.27 a bushel. That's our time for this week. As always, we thank you for your attention and for spending time with us. Along with Max Armstrong, I'm Orion Samuelson on the Market Sponsor.